Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. And what a day it is. There's tons of news. So we're going to start with some picks of the week.
Sure.
We're going to end with some picks of the week because there's so many good ones. The first one, Windows 10.
Windows 10, folks.
So if you are an IT pro and you want to check out Windows 10, we've got a link here for you. You can be on the Insiders program, and you can download it, install it now. Don't stick it on anything that is too awfully important, because
no.
This is just a preview.
Well, remember, we'll have some instructions in here on how to back up your images,
yeah.
You know, back up your machines. We would love for you to try it with actual upgrades, specifically upgrades from Win 7.
Mm-hmm.
We're allowing Win 7 upgrades to Windows 10. Want to get your experience, try it out with your different hardware, keep your hardware plugged in. Basically, let us know. There's lots of feedback.
So keep your hardware plugged in when you do the upgrade?
Yeah, so things like...
Because in the past, a lot of times I'd unplug everything, do an upgrade, and then kind of stick it in one at a time.
Generally, you shouldn't have to unplug things.
Yeah.
You should just leave it in and... It should just be as if, you know, you're doing an update.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how we want to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there's issues, do send us back logs.
Yeah.
We capture that and we go through them. You know, I actually go through those. Tell us what you think. There's feedback throughout the experience. You know, we'll pop notifications asking you, hey, what did you think about this? Give your honest feedback. There's scales, you know, 1 to 5, and then comments and stuff like that. We want to hear it. Try out your software, try out store apps. Just run it through its paces. Tell us what it's like to deploy.
And so this one is a preview for PC experts, IT pros.
Correct.
And if you're watching the show, I'm going to assume you are. If you have any questions, if you have any problems, just let us know. Gov will walk you right through that.
Right. And like I say, you know, it is going to take some effort, you know, and as we say, we're saying don't put this on, you know, your mom's machine that is, you know, only dedicated for her email or,
yeah.
You know, whatever, especially not without asking her first.
Yeah.
But, you know, try it out, get the feel for it, make sure that it's doing things that you expect it to do.
Mm-hmm. Send us some email, let us know what your favorite things are.
And backup.
Yeah. Okay, and then the other news since the last show is that we have announced a little something with Minecraft. So I'm very excited about that. You're like,
I haven't
played it.
I'm not unexcited.
Yeah.
You know.
But for those of us who play it all the time or have kids who play it all the time, very excited. One of the things that my kids always said was that I wish they updated it more. I'm hoping that we get into that. And we were talking earlier about like the ability to build things with blocks like that. It's
mm-hmm.
just it's a malleable way to just make any kind of environment you want. I kind of wish that you could scale the size of the person
mm-hmm.
so that you could build something with the blocks, but then scale up as a person so the blocks got smaller. But yeah, I'm really...
Giant Larry in Minecraft.
Giant Larry in Minecraft. That would be awesome. And one of the picks a week we have at the end of the show is another one that's kind of like silly putty for storytelling. So we'll talk about that too. All right, but let's get started with the questions. Question number one from Rich. He needs to recover a hard drive that connects. It's a platter drive. Rich Edwards, he's a friend of ours, and he was over at the house this weekend. He was talking about this platter drive that he had. It connects. It makes a sound, but he sees nothing on it, and he wanted to send it out to be recovered. In the way, way, way distant past, I would have used a utility like SpinRite, but those days are long behind us. What would be your method of trying to recover a drive nowadays?
I'd try to figure out, you know, what happened to it first. Like,
yeah.
Did it just suddenly stop working when you plug it in, and, you know, are you plugging it in with a USB interface, or you plugging it in via SATA interface. What does it show up as? Does it show up as RAW? Does it show up as, you know, NTFS, but with zero bytes? Mm-hmm. Does it look formatted? You know, there's lots of different things of what could possibly go wrong. There's various undelete utilities out there that has various success, but fundamentally, don't know, right? Yeah. You know, was it encrypted? If it was ever encrypted, then chances of recovering it are way down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have to get a lot more information about that drive.
Okay. And is there a difference between like plugging it into the eSATA and on like the motherboard and using an external USB?
There is. There is a difference.
What
yes.
What is the
well, you're just going through a different
that.
Controller. Mm-hmm. Some USB to SATA or some SATA to USB controllers are not created equal,
yeah.
Right? Some of them are out of spec. So I can't guarantee that what is being seen is actually correct.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be delivering enough power depending on what kind of enclosure, what kind of system that the that
That's
is being
true,
set
yeah.
up. So generally speaking, I like to take them and actually attach them to real machines
yeah.
with a direct connection.
On
to
the motherboard. Plug the power supply into it. Okay, good. All right, next question from Robbie. Can you talk about Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit for security? What's it really doing? Is it worth putting on all my machines? Does it interfere with AV programs? And are there any other tools like EMET that you would recommend?
So EMET is it's an interesting technology. So what it basically does is it injects itself into various processes looking for patterns and tries to prevent different types of exploits by guards. So it'll set up things like canary pages. It'll set up things where once it starts noticing things go bad, it'll just basically shut down the process.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that it can't interfere with AV in the sense that AV might notice it and their heuristics might be triggered by what Emmett is doing. It's kind of this interesting ballet between the technologies. Whether or not you want to put it on at home, you know, that's completely up to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you practice safe computing, the need for it goes way down.
Yeah.
Right? It's one of those things where in the enterprise where they tend to be, you know, rich targets, or, you know, you put it on externally facing servers, for example, or you're having to use older versions of the browser or older versions of applications for whatever business or technical reason that you might have, and not able to update it with the latest security patches, but you use Emmett in order to help offset that. If you're being kept up to date, you're running Windows 8.1 or you're running Windows 10 preview, the needs for Emmett go down because a lot of the technology that they use have been integrated into the OS.
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, for the home user, if you tried to put it on every process, I'm going to say yes, you're going to have issues. If you tried to put it on just for your browser, for example, it may work for you. You kind of have to try it out.
Cool. Okay. From Quan in the forums, he said, I want to use both Windows, or no, he says, I want to use Windows Performance Monitor to watch health of my laptop's hard disk drive. Which performance counters should I use to gather data about the hard drive bottlenecks and which values are sufficient? So Duncan McKenzie sent it to both shows. Andrew replied that physical disk queue length is a counter that you want, and over 2 is bad.
Yeah.
And you had some suggestions on...
Well, if you're trying to monitor the performance of the drive, but why are you trying to monitor the performance of the drive?
Like, yeah.
Are you noticing that it is slowing down? How old is the drive? Is it a spinning drive or is it an SSD?
It's always getting to the root of the problem with you.
I only ever tend to want to run a monitoring program if I'm noticing something wrong.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I want to have as little running as possible.
Yeah.
You know, so that there's no interference. There's no additional variables
mm-hmm.
that are in the way, right, of when I'm trying to do something.
Yeah.
If you have a monitoring app running all the time, then you start to forget about it, and now it kind of becomes this default state for you, And not everything is designed to work in that default, in your new default state. So if you install something, it may not work properly with that, with Performance Monitor running all the time.
Yeah.
And we don't know that because nobody runs with Performance Monitor running all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, to me, it's much more useful to understand why you actually want to do it. You know, is it a spinning drive? Is it an old drive? You know, as hardware gets older, it's just because they are hard and tangible does not mean that they do not wear out and, you know, eventually degrade in performance and reliability,
yeah.
Especially with spinning drives. But, you know, even with SSDs, they only have a limited number of write mm-hmm. operations. And actually, same thing with regular hard drives, like regular spinning drives. They are limited
yeah.
in their age. You know, some people have had really good luck. They've had hard drives for that have lasted for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that the drives are engineered is that there is smarts within the drive. It can self-detect when something is going wrong and write information to like a hidden slack space.
Yeah.
For want of a better term.
It's like compensation for a problem.
Exactly. But the user is never really aware of it. It happens within the drive circuitry mm-hmm. In the drive firmware.
To the user, the drive just still looks good.
Exactly. But in underneath the covers, it's failing, and then eventually it runs out of additional spare slack space in order
yeah.
to recover your data into, just says, I'm now starting to fail.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it starts to see the age and the wear of the drive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to this particular thing, if you're noticing problems, it's an older drive, back it up,
yeah.
start looking at, hey, what would it take to be more reliable? Get onto an SSD. I'm loving SSDs right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't go for cheap ones.
Yeah.
I go for the ones that I've put in recently are Samsung Evos.
Mm-hmm.
Nice drives. I wouldn't say that they're top of the line by any stretch of the imagination, but they are...
Good balance of price and performance.
Exactly. You know, I went for, in my dev box that I recently refurbished, I set up a 512 gig SSD as my host OS drive, and then I've got a RAID 10 array for where all my data and enlistment sit.
Yeah.
I'm getting massive perf gains. It's not even funny. And I have very little writing to my OS drive. I've actually mm-hmm. moved my temp folder to my RAID array.
Yeah.
So my system right now is very little wear and tear on the SSD. It's very nice not having the temp directory there because, you know, temp gets used all the time.
Yeah. Well, as you might remember from past shows, I used to run two SSDs
in RAID 0.
I love how you roll your eyes. I won't be doing that again. So,
right.
Yeah, that...
it's fine if you run in RAID 0.
It was awesome for a while.
As long as you make backups, as
yeah.
long as you don't have data on it, and as long as you're okay.
I didn't lose any data. It just got wobbly after a while. And it was just wobbly for...
Cheap SSDs in RAID 0 is even worse.
What are you saying? All right, next question. From Andre says, how does Windows Explorer and Windows 8.1 generate thumbnails of JPEG pictures? My dad was on vacation and made some pictures. When I see the thumbnails on Windows Explorer, all the pictures look fine. But when I open some of them via the photo app or desktop photo viewer of Windows, they are damaged. How can this be that thumbnails are fine and the open pictures are damaged? Do both apps use different ways to compare to the Explorer and read the pictures? This is a great question because I've always wondered this when I see thumbnails.
It was a fantastic question. I really like this one. It's actually funny. I had Andre send me a picture.
Yeah.
And then I used a tool on it. I didn't use this specific one, but I used a different one. It does the same basic thing. JPEGs are funny in that they are not just a picture.
Yeah.
It is not simply, you know, RGB values in a TIFF-like format.
Yeah.
It has additional metadata.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that metadata of a JPEG can be a thumbnail. And that gets populated by the actual device taking the picture, or, you know, through different photo manipulation software, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But since in this case it came from a camera directly, the camera created the thumbnail within the original JPEG. Mm-hmm. So you've got, say, something like a 4-meg JPEG, you know, I'm saying a really high-res JPEG.
Yeah.
Part of that data is an additional 640 by 480 thumbnail.
Yeah.
And that isn't actually the real picture. It's an offset in the metadata that is a binary stream that Explorer knows about because the file format that JPEG is well documented, knows which offset to look into, and parse that binary blob into a new photo. And that's exactly what Explorer does in this case, and that's why there's a difference in that mm-hmm. the thumbnails that Explorer shows up are from that JPEG.
Yeah.
And this tool here, this PhotoMe, is able to read, parse, edit that additional metadata. So if you have a corrupted picture and you don't necessarily care about the size of the picture that you're recovering, you could always recover the thumbnail.
Yeah.
And my suspect is that the way that the camera took the picture is, especially with digital cameras, is not like, okay, you press the shutter and it takes the sensor data and then in this case, did not simply resize the data or resize the picture in memory and then apply it as a thumbnail. What it did in this case, I'm assuming, is at the point where you're taking the, when you're pressing down the shutter, it'll take two passes of the sensor data. Mm-hmm. One pass of the sensor data, it saves as the picture, and the other pass of the sensor data, it saves as the thumbnail. Or the entire sensor itself has a, is essentially two sensors. There's a 640 by 480 sensor, and then the main sensor, and at the same time, it will take those two streams of data.
Yeah.
Not entirely sure about the internal mechanics of
so
the
was
camera.
So was it more than one picture that was corrupt, or was
yes.
it just the one?
No, it was more than one picture that was corrupt. Mm. Did a little bit of
research. I've had, like, sometimes when I run out of battery, the last picture I take will be corrupt.
This time, I think he talked about a couple, three pictures. I'm not entirely sure on the numbers. But this particular camera could have a firmware update that fixes it. Actually, I'm not too sure what caused it in the first place.
Yeah.
But just do know that the original pictures were corrupted.
Yeah. So you could recover the thumbnail, though.
You can recover
like
the thumbnail,
this, and at least you have something.
Exactly. You know, if it was a critical paparazzi picture, I don't know.
Yeah. So when you look at a directory in Explorer and you're seeing the pictures as thumbnails, I always kind of wondered, is it like saving thumbnails off somewhere else in another file?
But it saves it off. So what it'll do is it'll iterate through the JPEGs. It'll go and extract the thumbnail data.
Yeah.
It'll then take that thumbnail data, put it into a thumbnail database within the root of each folder.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a hidden file.
It's a hidden file, exactly. So that when you go back to that folder, it doesn't need to hit disk I/O for each file all over again. It'll just read the single file and get the thumbnails.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. All right, next question from Ian. I have two Office 365 accounts I use on my two Windows phones, one personal and one for work. Both have my personal Office 365 and corporate Office 365 mail accounts set up as the default mail app. The issue that I'm having is with my personal email account, it allows me to download mail from any time, but the corporate one only allows the last 2 weeks. Is there a configuration setting within Office 365 admin to control this setting, or is it because I have two accounts and to save space it gets restricted?
That's basically up to your corporate Exchange admin. It's their policy that sets up the data retention and what you're able to pull down.
Okay. Another one for me. How hard would it be for Microsoft to produce a version of Windows that has all the legacy cruft removed from it to make it leaner, to support those instances where some legacy files are needed and they could not be automatically downloaded on, or they could be automatically downloaded on demand using similar streaming technology used for running Office on demand? Well, a scaled down version of Windows is kind of the direction we started going with Windows 7.
Mm-hmm.
Windows 7 had, I mean, you can read the MSDN blog posts on it, but it was a smaller footprint that would run better on some of the older hardware than like Vista, for instance. And even Windows 8, there's some things that have been pulled out. You know, they're trying to move some stuff off to the store like Minesweeper and Solitaire. But talk about this. What is the method that Windows has gone to...
So footprint reduction is something that we're constantly looking at. The really hard part is defining what is really legacy and what is in use. Because just because something is really, really old doesn't mean that it is not constantly in use. For example, the comm subsystem. It is 25 years old.
Yeah.
It's still used. And it's difficult to tease apart what would be considered used or not used. It takes a lot of refactoring, and we're constantly doing this work in order to get smaller footprints. We did this work very heavily in Windows 8.1 spring release because of new devices, new 16 gig devices that were being produced. So you kind of have to think of it in terms of where did we start? Like, where were we coming from? And what has happened over the years? So if you go back to 2K and XP, for example, early 2000s, you're talking about drives that were approximately, like, generally speaking, people would have 40 gig drives, 20 to 40 gig drives. You would have the OS being relatively small, taking up, you know, in the end, 1.5-2 gigs worth, and then have a ton of space left over. And that was kind of where we thought everything was going, which is really, really large spinning drives. You know, as you go into the Vista era, you're looking at, you know, 500 gig drives, 250, 500 gig drives going into Vista Win 7. So it's like, well, size of the OS, does it really matter when you have that much free space? You can barely see a line anymore in Explorer with how little the OS was being taken up. Then comes in SSDs. SSDs, very expensive. And now we're kind of, we had to go back to the point of, oh, 32 gig SSD, right, where the OS, 64-bit OS, was taking up like 16 gig.
Yeah.
That half your drive is gone with the OS being taken up with that much. Like a 64-bit OS, 64-bit Win 7, for example, took around 16 gig when all was said and done. Relatively large footprint for a 32 gig device, very, very little for a 1 terabyte device.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of had to rethink all of that. So now we're trying to get the OS into that much, much smaller footprint to deal with tablets, to deal with mobile devices. And, you know, now we're looking at the Atom systems with 16 gig drives and, you know, the OS taking up a grand total of 4 or 5 gig.
Yeah.
We're still constantly trying to slim that down, but it's not easy because it's the more that we take out, something can break.
Yeah.
You know, you still want to run those legacy applications, and even newer apps, like you can compile an app or take an app that was compiled in 2014, but depending on how the developer wrote it or added to it, it could really be using technology from 2000.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't know. And it's not necessarily easy to say, okay, you're no longer able to use any technology from these previous OSs. You can only use technology that exists in the latest OS because as a developer, it's very difficult to only target that latest OS. So, you know, they're trying to target all of the OSs in use, which generally means coding to the lowest common denominator, which means going to the lowest legacy. So we kind of have to keep that legacy going forward.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's our burden, and it's also our strength.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very, very fine balance that we're having to strike. So
yeah.
What you may consider legacy cruft, another person might consider essential.
Yeah.
That's what we do to try and figure out what's safe to remove. It's one of my job functions, actually.
Yeah. When you have a billion users, you have to be cautious about where you set that bar. So, you know, billion users, one in a million problems still happens 1,000 times a day.
Exactly.
All right. Next question. I'm having some trouble deleting things in folders in Windows 7. The problem is that it says that the content is not present when I try to delete the folder. So I guess it's only a visual folder as the size of it is 0K. I've also tried to use Unlocker software, but since there's no actual data present, it fails. Is there some hack or method that would remove these folders? I've seen where I'm deleting a lot of different files at once. So, like, I'm going through pictures and deleting the ones that are bad or whatever. And sometimes if you're deleting fast, like, I'll delete a couple here, I'll move down, I'll delete a couple there, I'll go back up and say, oh, I thought I deleted those. You delete it again, and it's like, that file's not there. And it's usually because I'm doing things too fast and not giving the system, which is full of files, a chance to kind of catch up. And so usually if I wait a second or if I hit F5 to refresh, then that kind of fixes that. So I'd be curious on this one to find out if they're just doing things too fast or if they have something that's persistent between like shutting down Explorer, opening it back up and still having the problem, or even rebooting and it still is a problem. And if that's the case, write us. But when I've seen that in the past, it's just been me doing things faster than the system catches up with.
Yeah, usually it's something else has a handle to that location, and it's not releasing its handle, or it's not releasing its handle fast enough such that that folder disappears. Something only ever gets deleted when all the handles to it are closed.
Yeah.
So if you had something like a long search operation that was working on that folder, its handle is still open, then maybe the search indexer has to complete or at least tear down that work item before it'll release the handle, and then the folder will go away.
Okay. Next question. I have a very unusual situation where I'm remote desktoping to my Windows 7 PC for my laptop. The Explorer EXE process has been killed, so therefore the start menu and et cetera isn't available. And there's very little I can do with my PC, so I need to restart my PC. How can I restart my PC after the Explorer EXE process has been killed?
Okay, so I am TS'd into a machine right now. You can't use Control-Alt-Delete, but you can use Control-Alt-End, which will bring up the SAS Secure Attention Sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Here you can do a couple of things. If you really just want to reboot, you can choose to restart from the power.
Yeah.
Or you can choose Task Manager, go File, Run New Task, and then run a new version of Explorer, and that should get you your shell back in order for you to continue working with it. Then from there, you can obviously shut it down as well.
Yeah.
But Control-Alt-End is the equivalent of using Control-Alt-Delete on your local machine to bring up the same. So Control-Alt-End, this is on the remote, okay? Or Control-Alt-Delete, which is on the local.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, pick of the week time. Pick of the week. And so this one is kind of interesting. It's the Edison Robot Pack. And it's meetedison.com. It's a very cool little affordable robot for people that want to just kind of play around with this kind of thing. The thing that I like about this, there's a few things actually. One, it's affordable. It's very cheap. So it's $37 for one, and you can buy them in bulk if you've got like a school project that you want to do or something like that. They're very modular. They've got all the Lego connectors on them already. So if you want to build a simple car, you can have like one in the front, one in the back to build a fire engine, or you could do a bunch of different things. There's a few sensors on this, and you can see like some of the sensors will do like line detection, so you can draw a line that follows it. There's a light detection on there, so you can have it follow a flashlight or something. And the application that you use to program these is very visual. It's like a drag and drop, almost kind of reminds me of Kodu or something, where you can, I love that suit.
That's orange.
Yeah, it is. It matches the device. Yeah, good internet connection in
right
here, huh? Wi-Fi. It's an interesting thing. Try it out if you love that kind of robotic kit like that. Oh, another thing that you can do with it too is you can program these things with a barcode using the light sensor. So you can get like barcodes that do certain commands and just kind of scan those. Sound, it's got a sound sensor on it, so you can clap to make it do something. That's kind of cool. It's interesting. So definitely want to try one of these out. Throw it in my box of Lego stuff at home and make some cool cars or something.
I should get one. I like the sound activated stuff. See if my kid likes it.
Yeah. And they've got one where they kind of hook two of them together, and it looks like the wheels join, so you can make like a geared, you know, double drive system. It's kind of neat. So try that out. And then the other pick of the week that I wanted to talk about is something that we launched yesterday, and it is a preview of Sway. And Sway, this is what I was talking about with like silly putty for storytelling. This is a system that easily allows you to create a story using all kinds of rich media. Your story can be part text, go into video, go into pictures, go back to video, go back to text. It's a very simple way to make these rich media stories, and then it works across different devices very well. So this is something like back in the old days when I used to work a lot with journalists on like using Flash and stuff like this. This was the holy grail. I mean, this is what everyone wanted, was a way to do storytelling that didn't require you to do a bunch of programming, and it's just kind of a drag and drop easy way to do rich media storytelling. And here it is. So try this out. You want to get on the wait list now and give it a shot. I've got a couple of presentations coming up soon, and I'm going to use this to do the presentations because it's just a great way, especially like when I'm doing some what would have been PowerPoint. There's kind of a hard transition between slides, or like when I want to have a Channel 9 video or something play. And this just gives you a much more fluid, seamless way to go through it. It's all, you know, touch-based and everything. So really looking forward to this. It saves your stories out on the Sway website, and then you can just send people links. You can tweet. There's a lot of different things that you can import into Sway Stories, from like, you know, YouTube videos to tweets and stuff like that. So very cool. Check it out. Sway.com. Get on the wait list and let us know what you think.
Looks pretty cool.
And that is the show for this week. If you have questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and we will see you next week.
Take care.